Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. One week from today, it's opening ceremony time in Vancouver, Canada, for the 2010 Winter Olympics. Global warming hasn't nixed the Winter Games yet, though they're trucking in snow in Vancouver after the warmest January there on record. Canada's in a frenzy for medals. The U.S. has lots of contenders. If you're not a snow sport fan, you'll be learning a lot of new names soon. This hour on Point, we're pulling up the curtain on the Vancouver Winter Olympics. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for the games? Who are you rooting for? Which events will you be watching? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in this hour, we'll talk with David Steele of AOL Sports about this weekend's Great American Sports event, Super Bowl 44. But now, joining me from New York is Brian Cazenove. He's a staff writer for Sports Illustrated. He's covered 7 Winter Olympics, and not one to break a streak, is soon headed to Vancouver. Brian, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
It's just great to have you, and I should say we'll hear from a couple of U.S. Olympic athletes headed to Vancouver in this hour as well. But Brian, let's deal with the snow issue first. Everybody's talking about how warm it is in Vancouver, 45 degrees there recently. But give us the lay of the land. Where's the snow? Where is it not? You've got Vancouver by the sea, but events, what, 70, 75 miles off in the mountains? Is it okay for skiing, for snow, for winter?
I'll put my meteorologist hat on. Yeah. It's a very thin hat, I'm afraid.
Okay.
But, you know, it's interesting. Whistler, where the snow events will be held, seems to be pretty close to Vancouver on a map, but it's kind of a world away in terms of temperature and also volatility in the air. You go on the sea-to-sky highway, and suddenly your warm, balmy conditions in Vancouver turn into rather unpredictable conditions up there in Whistler. I think it'll be quite a bit colder if history holds true, and as it is, they have contingency. I mean, it's not the first time that at a Winter Games or a major event like a World Championship, they've needed snow, they've needed cold conditions. They have plenty of contingency built in the forms of many, many trucks full of snow, so I'm sure they'll be fine.
Okay, they'll have snow. Let's talk about Canadians. There will be a lot of them there, but Canada is focused on this Olympics and winning medals there in a way that maybe Americans can't imagine here. What's this, what's it called, Own the Podium campaign?
Own the Podium. Well, it's born out of Canada's problems winning medals in previous Olympics that have been held on Canadian soil. Only twice in Olympic history has the host nation failed to win at least one gold medal at a Winter Olympics or at an Olympics, summer or winter. Those two times were in Montreal 1976, the Summer Games, and Calgary 1988, the Winter Games, the two times that Canada has hosted the Games.
Yeah.
They don't want that to happen again, and especially given the fact that there are concerns about how these Games will do financially. A lot of Canadians still have a bad taste in their mouth from the bill they ended up paying for the Montreal Games after 1976.
Mm-hmm.
Calgary Games were more successful financially, but I think it would be a good distraction if the organizers could say, well, yes, we may have come out short a few million dollars, but look at what this did for the national psyche because we won all of these medals. And in order to produce that, they're doing something which is actually very un-Canadian. You think of them as friendly, welcoming hosts,
yeah,
but they've actually shut down a lot of their training facilities to athletes from other nations. You know, usually visiting athletes would like to find out what the facilities are like on home ice and snow, and they have limited that as much as possible just to Canadian athletes. So they're taking the medal count very seriously in Vancouver.
I'm reading the American speed skater here, Catherine Rainey, saying they're playing nasty. She's living and training in Utah, but she'd like to try out the facilities right there in Vancouver.
Well, and actually, there are some U.S. athletes who have trained part of the time or even most of the time in on Canadian facilities, and so they're essentially being evicted, if you will. They've had test events competitions at all of the venues, and that's mandatory as required by the International Olympic Committee. So most of the athletes have had a chance to see what the venues are like and the quirks and the unusual speed of the luge and bob track, for example, the turns that are specific to the ski runs. But the Canadians are able to use them all the time. And all of the athletes from not just the United States, but many of the European countries have found kind of a rude exclusion, if you will, from the people in Vancouver.
Brian, begin to introduce us to the American athletes that in the many hours, and NBC is saying across all of its outlets it'll be 800-plus hours, Americans will get to know very well in these Olympics. On the cover of your magazine, Sports Illustrated, you've got right off the bat Lindsey Vonn, America's best woman skier ever, is your headline.
Well, she has 32 wins in the World Cup in her career, and that is tops for a U.S. skier. And she has always been a strong skier across all of the disciplines, from the fast and straight downhill to the slower but more turny, if you will, slalom events. That's changed over recent years. She's been very, very much a better speed skier, the downhill and the Super G. She's had some equipment issues, changing equipment, and also some issues with a wrist injury, and you need your wrist in order to turn, and you really turn on the technical events, the slalom and giant slalom. So people will see her as perhaps the favorite in the downhill and the Super G events.
Brian, but if we can, on the slalom front, I've got a little tape here that would just to get a sense of her, at least listening to her coming down that slaloming here. This is at the FIS Alpine World Cup, France, 2009. Here she was earning her 25th career win on the women's super combined down here slalom, Lindsey Vonn.
No need for Vonn to rush into the rhythm. And seems to, at this point, be doing it just right.
Nice job. All about strategy for her. She built up the margin in the downhill. Now she's having a good one, a consistent one.
She's sniffing the finish and letting it go. And Vonn to the line finds a little bit more time. And the win. And the win for Lindsey Vonn. Victory number 25 on the career.
Lindsey Vonn hoping to repeat that at the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. 5'10", 160 pounds, 25 years old, and she skis on men's skis. Now, I don't know enough about it to know what that means. What's that say?
Well, they're a little bit longer and a little bit heavier, and the thought is that women would have a tough time navigating these skis and being able to turn them properly. She's really debunked that, and these skis have helped her because they're a little sturdier and they allow her to propel a little bit better. So she's really used them to her advantage in the speed events. As I said, because she changed equipment manufacturers over the summer in the slalom and giant slalom, she hasn't really found a rhythm. She's tried over 100 pairs of skis, new skis.
Wow.
And you know, that gives you an idea of how precise these things are. And but, you know, with those new skis, she's kind of setting the template now for other women skiers saying, hey, you know, this is working for her. And look at all these speed races she's winning. Maybe I should try this, too.
The U.S., in your count, coming up number 3 in the medal count overall, you're predicting Germany 35, Canada 30, U.S. 27. And how many are you thinking might be won by her, by Vonn?
Well, I think two events in which she'd be the favorite, the downhill and the Super G. She's had great success. Those are the fastest and the straightest of the events. She's had a lot of success on those this year. The wrist injury that she had earlier this year really hurt her in terms of being able to make quick, abrupt turns. And you have to make more of them in the shorter events like slalom and Super G. You really just have to turn very quickly, and I think that's affected her adversely. The interesting thing about Lindsey, by the way, is as secure as she is careening down a mountain at something like 90 miles an hour, she is an admitted klutz off the course. I mean, she actually hurt her thumb last year opening a champagne bottle.
Oh, boy.
and she ended up getting some jagged glass into the thumb, and she had to wear a brace. And then at home, she's married to a former skier, Thomas Vonn, and Thomas tells the story of being in the living room and hearing some searing noise in the kitchen. And he's, what's that? I mean, are you okay? And she yelled back and she said, oh, no, it's no problem. I just lit my eyelashes on fire. I'm fine.
That's all. Don't take that to the moguls. It could be tough. And who's likely to be the top medal winner for the U.S. team, Brian?
Well, I mean, Lindsay will do very well. There's also a speed skater who was there 4 years ago in Torino named Shawnee Davis. Mm. Shawnee is remarkable in the sense that in this day and age of speed skating, you know, people remember Eric Heiden winning 5 gold medals across all 5 speed skating disciplines, 500 to 10,000 meters. These days, most speed skaters are specialists. They are either sprinters or they are distance skaters. You're either good at the 500 and the 1,000, or you're good at the 5,000 and the 10,000, and the 1,500 is kind of a no-man's land event in between there. Shawnee Davis has enough range to contend at every single distance. And he was even earlier in his career an alternate on the Olympic short track team. He's not doing short track this year, but his range is phenomenal. He'll probably be the favorite to win the 1,000 meters and the 1,500 meters. Those are the two races he skated most often on the European circuit. But he could win something in the 500 or the 5,000. He's really a remarkable athlete.
Shawnee Davis, we'll come back and talk about him. The New York Times calls him a black man in an almost entirely white sport and with a training style all his own. Brian Casanova with Sports Illustrated, it's great to have you with us. Please stand by there in New York. Behind us right now, the theme song for the Vancouver Olympics, One Dream, written, performed by Canadian pop star Sarah McLachlan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Winter Olympics opening 1 week from today in Vancouver. The one crucial ingredient missing in some of the areas there, snow. Earlier this week, Olympics gold medalist snowboarder Shaun White was a guest on Late Night with David Letterman. And, of course, those snowless slopes or the fear came up.
You're off to Vancouver for the Olympics. Do they have enough snow there for your event?
I'm hoping. You know, it's been funny. We're getting these random rumors that are coming out of Vancouver that they're saying that there's Russian helicopters flying the snow in, or there's actually building the half pipe out of hay and then covering it with snow. These are true stories, so I'm curious to see what they do.
Well, I do know that they're inviting ticket holders. They're requesting that they bring their own snow.
A little
snow. So if you're planning on going, do what you can.
BYO snow. Brian Casanova with Sports Illustrated is with us. The Vancouver Games will be the 8th Olympics he's covered for the magazine. They've got quite incredible coverage in their issue out now. We're lucky enough to hear from a couple of American Olympians in this hour. We're going to hear in just a second from Shauna Robach. Here's the soundtrack to one of her recent victories at the 2009 Women's Bobsled World Cup in Königssee, Germany, a year ago.
Shauna Robach, the former professional soccer player, and
big
Valerie
speed.
Fleming, the track and field athlete, looking to give the USA their first gold medal of the season,
yes.
And they do it. Second best run of the heat, best overall time, 141.91. Gold medal, USA. Silver for Germany and Great Britain.
Gold medal for Shauna Robach. She joins us now from Park City, Utah. Bobsledder, pilot for USA 1. She's a gold medal favorite going into the Vancouver Olympics. Shauna Robach, thank you very much for being with us.
No, thanks for having me.
So where are you in your training right now? What are you doing every day?
Well, right now I'm in Park City, and we're just training every day up at the Olympic Park here, getting some runs in right before we head up to Vancouver.
And how many, I don't know, runs a day do you do? Is that how you, you know, calculate your training, Shauna?
Well, when we're in competition, we only get 2 runs a day. But because we're here at the park, we can take as many as we want, but I'm only taking 2.
Have you been up to Vancouver and the mountains outside the city? Have you seen what you're going to be working on there?
Yes, I have. We had a World Cup there last year, and we were up there earlier this year for 2 weeks.
What do you make of it as a venue?
Oh, it's beautiful. The venue is crazy. It's super fast, and the track is awesome.
Brian Cazenove in New York, tell us about Shauna and her crew and what the prospects are. How do you see them?
So, putting the pressure on me as she's
yes.
listening in, I think they're excellent, and I'm curious because from what we hear, as she said, the track is super fast and maybe not as turny as some of the tracks in Europe, but the speed is really, from what they say, second to none. Do you think that's the case, and how do you think that might benefit your chances?
Yeah, I mean, the track is very fast, and it's the fastest track in the world. I think in the four-man race, it's going to be very interesting. I think who stays on all four runners is going to win the race. my chances, I think they're pretty good. I mean, I won the World Cup event there last year. I feel pretty comfortable going into the Olympics, and, you know, I just can't wait to get it started.
Shauna, what determines how fast a track is? Is it just about how steep or how straight, or are there other elements that come into play for bobsled?
I think the grade of the track and the radius of the curves. If you have tighter curves, they're going to slow you down. But I think definitely the pitch and the grade of the track.
And give us a little short course here. How do you keep those runners, you know, on the ice? What's the secret to that happening, if that's what's going to make the difference between winning and not?
On this track, I think you have to get through the 50-50 curve, which is curve 13. So I think that will be the key.
Get through it, meaning not fly off or just keep your runners down when you're there? What does it mean exactly? I've never bobslid.
No, keep the runners down. That's what that means.
So is it all about where you're leaning, where you're throwing your weight as a crew?
Yeah, we don't really lean. It's cool runnings is... It's not really what we do.
Okay.
Showing cool runnings. People don't kiss eggs and stuff like that.
So what's the secret then? It must be where you put your center of gravity or not?
No, it's just me driving. People think that I have a steering wheel. I actually have D-rings that are hooked to a T-bar up front. When I pull them back and forth, it moves the runners. So my brakeman, actually, she needs to be still in the back and just kind of let the track take her. She shouldn't be stiff. So it's kind of what I do in the front.
Shauna, you must have been an athlete for a long time, but how does a person become an Olympic bobsledder? How did that happen?
I got recruited in college. I did track and soccer there, and at that time...
This was at Brigham Young? You were...
Yep, uh-huh. At Brigham Young University. And one of the drivers was looking for better brakemen, and 2002 was the first time women's bobsled was in the Olympic Games, so... She just was going around telling the track coaches, hey, can you send your athletes out? So I came out, tried out, and here I am.
Did it sound crazy when she first raised it, you know, be a bobsledder? You were doing track and soccer, not exactly going down an ice, you know, channel.
Yeah, I had no idea. I mean, I know people ask so many questions about bobsled, and they're like, I'm sorry I'm asking so many questions. But I had no clue about bobsled when I got into it. So, you know, when people ask questions, I don't really mind. But it is crazy to think that I'm bobsledding.
What's your best event here, if that's the right question? What kind of time are you hoping for, Shauna?
Man, I don't even know the times in Vancouver, actually. The fastest time.
Wow, you're confident.
Just I just hope do to it. See a number one on the clock when I get down.
Hey, we're all for that, and we wish you every bit of luck in making that happen. We're very grateful to you for being with us.
All right, thank you very much for having me.
Shauna Robach on the U.S. Winter Olympic team. She's a bobsledder there, pilot for USA One, a gold medal favorite going into Vancouver. Brian Cazenove with Sports Illustrated is with us from New York. Let's get a call from Mark in Mansfield, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've been to the Olympics a couple times and my wife another time beside that, and we found that we weren't able to afford to go to these Olympics, even though, you know, we're probably at the most flush time we've had so far in our lives. And I just wondered if my experience was typical, if these are really expensive games or I just had bad luck.
Lucky for you being so flush right now, is it the air tickets or the actual tickets to events, Mark, that were high?
You know, the whole thing's really confusing because each time we've gone, there's been a different system. In Atlanta, it seemed like the Olympic Committee bought everything up, and then when you got a right to tickets, you also got a right to airplanes and hotels that they had sort of controlled, and that made things very affordable. It didn't seem like there were really high prices. In Salt Lake City, it seemed like everything was a la carte, but we still were able to do it.
Yeah.
This time, using the websites and the packages, I'm not sure what pieces were what, but to go to really like the most preliminary and worst events and stay very, very far from them in very modest hotels, when you added it together, it was, you know, maybe $5,000 each, even to do something that was a really, really marginal experience.
Wow, interesting. So you've got to, like, have some bank to even be in the bleachers there. Brian, I'm sure you just wave your press pass and swan in, but do you know about what this cost and what people, attendees, will be facing on that front?
You know, I have friends who are going there as spectators. I think from Olympics to Olympics, it's different, but sometimes it's easier to piecemeal things together, especially because sponsors end up with an allotment of tickets, and you don't know how many of those they might use. And so if you nose around at the last minute, some of those may become available because a lot of them aren't made available to the general public right away. And, you know, a lot of the hotels probably are able to boost their rates. And so, you know, they have them locked in from a year ahead of time. I mean, we knew, for example, where we were staying about a year in advance of the games. So sometimes, I don't know if that would have been the case in Beijing. It might have been more tricky. But if you were to go to Vancouver and do some scouting around at the last minute, you might have a little more success. But as I say, it probably depends on the on the demand from games to games.
Well, most of us watching on the screen, small screen or pretty big screen in a lot of places, homes these days. Pete in Paul Smith, New York. Pete, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Well, I want to bring into people's attention a sport of biathlon, which is two completely different disciplines of cross-country skiing and then marksmanship. And these guys, it's a huge sport in Europe, probably the most popular sport in Europe. It's like NASCAR over here. It's amazing. And we have a boy right here from this road who actually wore the yellow bib twice in Europe this year, in Oberhof and then in Ruhpolding, Tim Burke. And he's been on a podium a couple of times this year, and it'd be great if people followed biathlon because it is such a wonderful and exciting sport.
Tim Burke in biathlon. Pete, I appreciate the heads up, and we will follow it. We're actually lucky enough to have with us right now from Vancouver Island in Canada, Lowell Bailey, who is a biathlete, a U.S. biathlete competing in his second Olympics. And as you say, it's a sport. It's a combination of cross-country skiing and precision target shooting. Lowell Bailey, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here. And I'd like to say hi to Pete as well. I haven't heard his voice in a while.
Oh, you know Pete? You must know Tim Burke as well, a teammate?
Yes, Tim and I have been teammates since I think we were 10 years old.
So you do this. You do the skiing and shooting event. Describe it for us. How does it work? How many miles? How much do you shoot? What do you shoot at?
We are in a sport that's, for the large part, European-based, but it's gaining popularity over here. So the sport is done in kilometers or measured in kilometers, and we ski up to 20 kilometers depending on the format of the race. And during a race, you'll ski a loop, come into the shooting range, and either lie down or remain standing and shoot at five targets.
So you've got the rifle over your back as you're skiing. What's the origin of this sport, Lowell?
I believe it's a military background in Scandinavia.
So this would be like their rangers out in the woods skiing and being prepared to shoot. What's the secret to precision shooting after the exertion of cross-country skiing? It must be in part just being steady enough after that exertion to hit the target.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the most important part of this sport is coming in after you're at your maximum physical output and then somehow figuring out how to calm your body down and relax enough to focus in on a target that's, you know, not much more than 2 inches in diameter.
Can you take us in with a sort of very tight sense of how you go from being on your skis to being on the ground, sighting through the sight of your rifle? Is there a sequence of precise moves that you do to efficiently do that? Because it's a time race.
Yeah, absolutely. You're always the stopwatch is always running. So we practice that aspect of the sport literally thousands and thousands of times before going into a race. And so there's a complex series of movements that happen once you enter the shooting range on your skis.
Mm-hmm.
Then you, of course, you have the rifle on your back. You come to your shooting point and get down as quickly as you can after you've taken your poles off. As you're kneeling down onto the mat,
mm-hmm.
you're also taking off your rifle from your back. You're loading a magazine with the five rounds that you'll shoot,
mm-hmm.
And then getting into position, which is a modified shooting position because you have skis on, but you're lying down with the rifle, and then you take five shots, and then when you're finished, you have to do basically that whole series of movements in reverse.
To be back up on your skis and on your way.
Yeah, and all that happens in around 25 seconds.
You've got to be the Zen master of the down and back up again, and you've done that thousands of times, Lowell.
Yeah, probably, I don't know, maybe hundreds of thousands of times. I don't know. It's too many to count.
Brian Cazenove, what do you make of this event and the kind of training that goes on for this one in particular?
You know, if you ever watch this event at one of the World Cups in Europe, I mean, it's fascinating. You can tell, because there are monitors for spectators to watch, you can tell if somebody hits a target or misses a target because there are these five bursts of cheers or groans that follow their favorite athletes along. And somebody like, Ole Einar Bjørndalen, who is a really popular and very successful Norwegian, has his legions of fans who will follow him from race to race all over Europe. And they're very recognizable by the colors on their faces. And, as I said, it has a rhythm to it. And the person who called in and mentioned NASCAR is really right on, because the spectators are so dedicated to this, and the way people get into it, it's as passionate an event over there as you'll see, and it probably will take a medal from somebody like a Tim Burke, who the caller mentioned, who's mm-hmm. had some podium places this year, mm-hmm. to get more people involved with it, to get more people interested in it, to bring some races over to the United States, which would really help exposure. But when you see it in person, you get it. It's really a fascinating thing to see.
Lowell, you're a songwriter and singer as well, and you've got one we're going to hear in just a minute called Fire Them Down, and that's a phrase from your sport.
Yeah, it actually, the song, it definitely started out as more of a joke between we have one of our head coaches is from Sweden, and we were in Sweden for a training camp, and one of his friends knew that I was into music and had done some recording, so we actually collaborated on this song that was originally just supposed to be a sort of fun, kind of funny joke for the World Championships at the time, which was in Sweden, and so he wrote a song, a melody. I wrote some lyrics that had to do with, this team from North America that was coming over to fire them down.
Is great. It's good to know you can sing while you're in training there. Lowell Bailey, biathlete, U.S. Olympian, headed to Vancouver. Thank you very much for being with us, Lowell, and great luck to you in Vancouver.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Winter Olympics opening 1 week from today in Vancouver. We will get a little preview of the Super Bowl later in this hour, which, of course, is coming up this weekend in Miami. But on the kind of other corner of the continent, everything in readiness, except maybe the weather, and enough snow, we're assured, standing by on that front as well. Vancouver goes from sea level, obviously, right up within 70 or 100 miles into the mountains. It is dramatic. Brian Cazeneuve with Sports Illustrated has been with us this hour. They've had great coverage of all the buildup to the games, and you can join us as well. Are you ready to hit the slopes, the rinks, the luge runs, the ski jump? Here's a little sound of a contender on the U.S. team, Apollo Anton Ono, a short track speed skater. Here he is blasting through the competition to take the gold and his ninth national title at the 2007 World Cup.
Here comes Leo Suk to the front. Nice move, but a smart move by Hamlin to get into second place to try to split the Koreans. You don't want to see them together, and here comes Ono. Even with a little slip, Ono takes it all the way to the front, effortless.
There's Ono. Brian, tell us about Ono and his prospects.
His prospects are very good, and he's actually trying to make a little bit of history. He has 5 Olympic medals in his resume right now. That is one short of the record for U.S. Winter Olympians. Bonnie Blair had 6 total medals, not just gold, but total, over her 3 Olympics, and this will be Apollo's 3rd Games. So if he wins 2, he will have the most medals of any U.S. Winter Olympian. He has 3 individual races and a team race, and he's skating very, very well. He has a very good chance to do it. The amazing thing about him is that for somebody in a sport like short track speed skating, which sounds a little esoteric to people, he's really been a crossover personality. You know, he won this Dancing with the Stars competition.
Okay.
He has his face on his own airplane with Alaska Airlines. He has commercials for, you know, chocolate. He has equipment. He has all of these things that really have allowed him some creature comforts. And you would think that after 2 Olympics and a lot of opportunities outside of his sport, he might get lazy. But if you talk to some of his teammates and coaches, they are amazed at the fact that he is still the hardest working guy out there. You know, he puts in more hours and more intense workouts than people who are younger and in theory should be hungrier than he is. It's a tremendous credit to his willingness to try to take his sport to the next level and to remember where he came from. I think, once again, you'll see him on the podium in Vancouver, and that might make him a history maker as well.
And take us back to Shawnee Davis for a minute. You mentioned earlier his amazing range, the range of skating events that he's working in. He's also got a very sort of singular training style and attitude toward approaching the Olympics. His face is not on the side of an aircraft.
No, it really isn't. I mean, Shawnee's African-American. He grew up in the Chicago area. I think he's always felt quite a bit like an outsider. It is, as you referenced earlier, sort of a lily-white sport. There are not that many African-Americans who ever get introduced to speed skating. And I think he was a little bit leery of people from a very early point in his life. There's been a bit of a wall up between Shawnee and some of his teammates, and that also has meant that there's a wall up between his ability to make money and the sponsors who might be willing to welcome him. I think, you know, if you want to say that there's blame for something like that, it's kind of a shared blame. I mean, I don't think the wall has needed to be that high from his perspective, but I don't know that people have reached out to him in the way that perhaps they should as well. Last time there was a teammate, Chad Hedrick, who was from Texas. And, you know, he and Shawnee kind of clashed on a couple of issues. Shawnee didn't participate in a team race. Chad felt that he should have participated and said, well, it's un-American not to support your teammates. And Shawnee pointed out, well, you know, I have to prepare for the next race right afterwards where I have a chance to win. And he did win. So I think there have been some obstacles there that have been exacerbated unnecessarily by the parties involved. He also has trained on his own away from the U.S. national team, and so he hasn't had the funding that some of them had. He's had his own individual sponsor, and that's caused a bit of a, not so much a rift, but a distance between Shawnee and some of the U.S. teammates. I think a lot of that's been patched up.
Good.
And I think he'll do very well in spite of it.
A very powerful contender on the ice. Let's get a call from Janice in Jericho, Vermont. Hi, Janice, you're on the air.
Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess I'm pretty much what you would call an Olympics junkie. I kind of know coming up in the next couple of weeks I'm not going to get any sleep because I watch everything, and even the obscure sports. And living up here in northern Vermont, I'm able to get Canadian channels, and more often than not, I watch the Canadian broadcast of the Olympics. You know, I've been up here for 8 years, and I pretty much only watch Canadian broadcast.
Why the Canadian broadcast, Janice? Why not the NBC?
I find that the American broadcasts seem to focus so much on the American athletes, and it gets almost a little too much of the drama and not as many sports. I can watch so many more events on the Canadian channel, and a lot of the obscure ones, like your caller was talking about biathlon before. You know, we love watching biathlon. We were just watching the biathlon, I think it was the World Championships this last weekend on the CBC. And curling and skeleton and lots of hockey, of course. It just feels like we get a lot more of the events and a lot more of the world feel of the Olympics rather than the very American-focused coverage on NBC.
Yeah, Janice, we got it. It's a great report, and it may send some people looking for just that on their cable span if they can get it. And thanks for that. Let me invite into our conversation right here from Lake Placid, New York, no stranger to winter sports and Olympics, Duncan Kennedy, former three-time Olympic loser, competed in the games in Calgary, Albertville, and Lillehammer. He's now a development coach with USA Luge. Duncan Kennedy, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We heard from a bobsledder, now luge in the same hour. It's got to be Winter Olympics season. How's the U.S. luge team look this year, Duncan?
Well, it's interesting. We have a wide mix on the team, if you will. The event that's probably the most difficult to break into the medals, which is the women's singles event, is probably where we stand the best chance with Erin Hamlin. However, Benchoff is... Tony Benchoff in the men's singles is starting to show some good speed, and you certainly can't count out Grammett and Martin in the doubles category. They've had a rough season so far, but they seem to pull it together in the big events.
And now, luge, describe for us the difference between bobsled and luge. And I'm sorry that's such an obvious question, but, you know, a lot of people may not know.
Well, no, it's not really. There's certain things aesthetically that are obvious. The size of the sled, obviously, the number of athletes on the sled. But basically, as far as the physics of the sliding sports are concerned, all three are very tightly knit. And, you know, it's interesting to speak with other athletes from the other sliding sports and discover the similarities because, after all, we're all running on the same track. So
luge is where you're stacking horizontally. Yeah. Is it lugers? What's the origin of that? It's almost like something out of Dr. Seuss, or maybe not. Maybe we've all done it as kids.
Well, certainly. I mean, the origin dates way back, more of a primitive form of luge, which was actually sitting up slightly on the sled, and eventually it evolved into laying all the way back. Now, you know, you mentioned stacked on top of one another. Doubles appears as though they're just laying on top of one another. However, there is a seat that the top man is sitting on. However, they are in close contact, and it's important to maintain that contact for the stability of the sled.
You've got, I was reading, Duncan, it's kind of incredible, but you've got up in Lake Placid, a fantasy camp where people can come and do the luge for a price. What's it like for people who aren't pros at this, who aren't Olympians? You know, are they stunned at the speed? Can you manage it first time out, or do you have to build up to it?
Well, keep in mind, the Fantasy Camp is a great program because it's a three-day program. It costs about $2,000, and $800 of that is actually a tax-deductible contribution to U.S. Luge. But it's a great program in a sport that seems so inaccessible to the general public. But one important thing to keep in mind, whether it's a fantasy camp or it's a younger athlete that we're trying to recruit, it's a very user-friendly interface to get involved with luge. We don't just take athletes up to the top of the hill and fire them down and say
right.
Good luck.
Right.
You start near the bottom of the track going very slow, maybe 30 miles an hour, gaining skills. And as you gain skills, you slowly move up the track. And so, there's nothing overwhelming about it right off the bat. But at the same time, that 30 miles an hour feels like 130 sometimes.
I'm sure it does. Brian Cazeneuve, all this Olympic talk, and we've barely scratched ice dancing, which gets a very big TV audience. But I'm reading the U.S. maybe not in medal contention there this year. What do you say?
Well, it's quite a transition from luge to ice dancing.
Yeah.
You know, of the figure skating events, the four events, men's, ladies, pairs, and dance, I think actually we're strongest in the dance. We have two dance teams that have a chance to win medals, and one that won a medal last time, Tanith Belbin and Ben Augusto. And Tanith, oddly enough, is born in Canada, so she has U.S. citizenship and she's going home. But over the last year or two, the other pair, Davis and White, have kind of surpassed them as the top, you know, U.S. contender. So this is an event in which U.S. teams were not very good for quite a while, and now we have a chance to actually win two medals compared to, let's say, the ladies, which, you know, everybody knows about the names of, you know, Peggy Fleming and and Dorothy Hamill and Michelle Kwan and people who have been such stars over the years. We probably won't be on the podium in ladies figure skating. So actually there's a chance to win something on the men's side with both Jeremy Abbott and Evan Lysacek, and in the dance side, which, you know, those two couples that I just described.
Well, 1 week from today, and thanks to you all, we'll go in with our eyes wide open. Duncan Kennedy in Lake Placid with USA Luge. Duncan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Brian Cazeneuve, your coverage has been terrific, and your time with us today, very generous. We're really grateful for it. Have fun in Vancouver, and thanks for being with us, Brian.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Go out with a little more Olympic theme in a moment. We will look ahead to Super Bowl 44 in Miami this Sunday. This is On Point. On the other side of the continent, it's Super Bowl Sunday this weekend, with an audience of 100 million expected to tune in for Super Bowl 44, a.k.a. Super Bowl XLIV, and the game in Miami. Joining me from Laurel, Maryland, for a preview is David Steele, senior writer for AOL Sports. David, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So what do you make of the matchup this weekend? Is this one for the ages, or one of those, you know, every once in a while there's a Super Bowl that's kind of a dud as a game? What are you expecting here?
I'd be shocked if this was a dud. I mean, I think that everybody who watched the two conference championship games a couple weeks ago, as soon as I saw that the Colts and the Saints had come out of it and had made it to the Super Bowl, I think that the anticipation just kind of shot through the roof. And this is it's amazing that a Super Bowl that's not going to have Brett Favre in it and is not going to have a New York team in it either is still going to be what I believe is going to be one of the most highly anticipated and watched games ever in the Super Bowl, between the kind of story that the Colts have become with Peyton Manning, and certainly with what New Orleans and the Saints and the ties that they have, and the meaning and the impact that that their presence after Hurricane Katrina is going to have on the rest of the country watching this game.
Strong teams and hard fought all the way to the Super Bowl here with the Indianapolis Colts and the New Orleans Saints. Characterize these two teams for us, David. What are the strengths of each? How do they stack up?
Well, one of the reasons everyone's going to be watching is because they're a couple of our offensive juggernauts, if you don't mind the a little
fine
cliche. This is one of those years
it's sports.
That it's really appropriate. Yeah, the jargon is kind of inescapable this
right.
time around, because they really know how to put up points. I mean, these are two of the best offenses run by two of the best quarterbacks of our era. I mean, Peyton Manning is being discussed among the greatest of all time, and if he wins this Super Bowl, it'll be his second, and people start putting him in the category, maybe not quite of the Joe Montanas and Terry Bradshaws, the people with four Super Bowls, but he'll have two, and he'll be in that conversation with the greatest of all time based on all of his numbers and accomplishments.
Peyton Manning is from New Orleans. His dad, Archie Manning, was quarterback for the Saints.
He was the quarterback from the Saints. He grew up in New Orleans. Eli Manning, the quarterback of the Giants, and his brother, they're all New Orleans people. And the great thing is that Archie Manning isn't even torn about this. I mean, he's a part of New Orleans history. He's embedded in the community. He feels the pain that everybody else does, but he's rooting for his son. So,
New Orleans man roots for Indianapolis. How does Drew Brees compare as a quarterback?
Drew Brees is, you know, you almost can't even say, you want to say underrated just because he's not quite on the stature of Peyton Manning and Tom Brady and the others, but the numbers that he's put up the last several years, I mean, a year ago he passed for 5,000 yards, and literally only a handful of players in the NFL history have ever done that. And he has just been, he's been the catalyst for the Saints team. And you got to remember that these are two teams that reached December with a chance to both go undefeated. And the Saints started off 13-0, the Colts started off 14-0. They were head and shoulders above the rest of the league. The reason was because they put up so many points. They have such explosive offenses. They both have shown ways to come back from any deficit or any adversity that you can think of on the football field. And they held up their end of the bargain once the playoffs began and did what they had to do, playing on their home field and winning in dramatic fashion each time. So
is it passing versus ground game here, or they both got the whole array, David?
It's going to be an aerial show. It really is. I mean, I think you won't be seeing a lot of the 3 yards in the cloud of dust or explosiveness from the backs. I mean, these are two teams that put the ball up, and they're almost like state of the art offensively when it comes to passing the ball. And they've also got the thing is they also have big play defenses as well. So as much as you see maybe a big play going down the field in the passing game, you may see also a big interception going the other way or a big fumble or a sack that turns into a big play. There's a lot of speed on both sides. These are extremely talented, skilled position players on both sides of the football for both teams. I mean, these two teams are really at the top of their games. I mean, you hear that every year at the Super Bowl. You hear hype, and you're driven crazy by the end of the 2 weeks. But these are two teams that really, honestly, as far as football itself goes, they really do live up to all the hype. I mean, they're as good as advertised this year.
Indianapolis, Hungary, New Orleans, just would love to put that Super Bowl ring on the end of a long time of Katrina history. And the Who at halftime? What? Who knew they were still around, David?
You and a lot of other people. Boy, they're going to be surprising a lot of people I showed up there. So that'll bring a lot of eyeballs to the screen as well.
Yeah, flashing back eyeballs, maybe.
Exactly.
David Steele, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Tom.
And there we go to the Super Bowl. David Steele, senior writer for AOL Sports. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.